am print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. The date for this edition is November 11th, 2019. Welcome back. And we now go to the front of the magazine. And we are at this regular feature called For the Record, a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated with a two-color illustration or a caption in bold or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner margin of the page is a story illustrated by the numerical statistic in bright red, 780. Caption explains, days the U.S. Air Force mysterious unmanned X-37B space plane spent in orbit. 780 days in orbit. Mysterious unmanned space plane, says Time. And this is also illustrated by a red and white and black line illustration of presumably what the space plane might look like. It is unmanned because there are no windows and the Earth is in the background, a black and white line drawing of the Earth. Time's caption goes on to say it landed on October 27th. In the lower right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation in black and all caps from Barb Fagy, executive director of Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue, 1 year after the temple became the site of the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. And the quotation from Barb Fagy, or Feige, quote, "We'll forever remember the 11 lives that were lost, but we will go forward," unquote. In the lower center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Michael V. Drake, chair of the NCAA Board of Governors and president of the Ohio State University, announcing on October 29th that the board had voted to allow college athletes to be paid for the use of their image. And the quotation in all caps and gray from Michael V. Drake, chair of the NCAA Board of Governors and president of the Ohio State University, quote, "We must embrace change," unquote. In the lower left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the numeric statistic in red, $26.6 million. Caption explains, price at auction on October 27th of a 13th century painting that had been found in a French woman's kitchen. $26.6 million. That story is also accompanied by a three-color drawing of, presumably, a French woman stirring a stew on a hot plate in front of what is apparently a representation of that painting. $26.6 million. In the left margin of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, steak, that is spelled S-T-E-A-K, steak, Bad Week. Legendary New York City steakhouse Peter Luger got a zero-star New York Times review. Under Good Week, burgers. Burger King reported sales up 10%, partly because of the meatless Impossible Whopper. In the upper left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Claudia Lopez after becoming the first woman elected mayor of Bogota. And the quotation from Claudia Lopez, quote, not only did we win, but we are changing history, unquote. Caption goes on to say, Lopez, who is gay, took more than a third of votes in the October 27th election. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the numerical metric in red, 110 million plus. Caption explains, U.S. downloads of Chinese-owned social media app TikTok, per an October 23rd letter, in which two senators called it, quote, a potential counterintelligence threat, unquote. The private company denied Chinese state influence. 110 million plus U.S. downloads. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from a letter from more than 250 Facebook employees to founder Mark Zuckerberg and top executives, criticizing their decision to allow politicians to make false claims in political ads on the site, according to an October 28th report in the New York Times. And the quotation from a letter from more than 250 Facebook employees, quote, free speech and paid speech are not the same thing, unquote. In the upper center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Popeyes, announcing on October 28th that its chicken sandwich would return to stores on November 3rd, more than 2 months after the chain sold out of the popular meal. And the quotation from Popeyes, quote, y'all, the sandwich is back, unquote. That was the entire content of the For the Record page. And that leads us to entering the major opening section called The Brief. And the first subsection in the brief is called Opener. We're now in the section called Terrorism of Opener, where the headline is The World After al-Baghdadi, article by Carl Vick and W.J. Hennigan. The death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi may not change the world. Nevertheless, how it came about says a fair amount about how the world he has departed. In the chain of events that led to the October 26th demise of the ISIS leader, every link tells a story. But even as it crystallizes about what the war on terrorism looks like 18 years after 9/11, al-Baghdadi's death may mark the beginning of an uncertain new chapter. The first link begins with the government of Iraq, which in September arrested one of al-Baghdadi's wives and a courier. Intelligence pointed to Syria, where the CIA was already working with the Kurdish militia. Both Iraq and the Kurds are committed enemies of ISIS. Iraqis suffered tens of thousands of casualties pushing ISIS out of their country from 2014 to 2017, and Kurdish militias lost some 11,000 fighters finishing the job in Syria, where the group's claim of a caliphate was erased. Their involvement underscored that this is a global fight. The U.S. is not going it alone. The people actually prosecuting the war on terror are overwhelmingly local and Muslim in Iraq and Syria, but also in Libya, Niger, Chad, Mali, Somalia, southern Yemen, and much of Afghanistan, where more than 58,000 Afghan national military and police forces lost their lives through 2018. Typically, the U.S. military role in these missions is restricted to half a dozen or more special operations commandos working with local forces by providing intelligence, training, and air cover. The local forces are mostly Muslim. Kurdish fighters in Iraq and Syria continue to battle ISIS and hunted al-Baghdadi even after American forces retreated from those countries. On October 6th, Trump ordered U.S. troops to pull back from territory held by the Kurds, who were left alone to face an attack by Turkey. Quote, I don't think we could have done this without the help we got from the Syrian and Iraqi Kurds, unquote, a U.S. official told Time, speaking of the operation against the ISIS leader. The official quickly added that Iraq military and intelligence officers, quote, kicked the whole thing off, unquote. Al-Baghdadi's trail led east. He appeared to have gone to ground not near the lush Euphrates Valley, where ISIS fighters made their last stand in Syria, and where his fighters still mount ambushes and suicide attacks, but in Idlib province, the last large section of Syria still controlled by rebel militias, which in turn are dominated by an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. That's the next link in the war on terrorism. It's far from over. Militant Islam may hold scant appeal to the overwhelming majority of the world's 1.8 billion Muslims. Parenthetically, a 2015 Pew Center survey found almost no more support for ISIS in Lebanon than in Israel. But a terrorist attack does not require great numbers, and chaos gives extremism both oxygen and maneuvering room. Not by chance are ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and their offshoots found in the globe's least governed sections. Like Syria, during its 8-year civil war, the country was a proving ground for jihadists, many drawn by the sectarian nature the conflict quickly assumed. The Damascus government of Bashar Assad is dominated by Alawites, a heterodox religious minority. Assad's brutal answer to peaceful Arab Spring protests by Syria's Sunni Muslim majority was answered by a range of armed groups, including extremists, who dominated the rebel battlefield. ISIS was a latecomer, having begun across the desert border as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. There, ISIS fought the U.S. occupation while slaughtering Shiite Muslims and religious minorities. Al-Baghdadi, born Ibrahim Awad Ibrahim Ali al-Badri 48 years ago in a village in central Iraq, took his nom de guerre from the capital city, where he got a Ph.D. in Quranic studies. He was swept up in arrest by U.S. forces in 2004. And, during almost a year in custody, turned his prison tent into an incubator of extremism. After release, he joined the armed group he would in 2010 come to lead. All three of the leaders who preceded him, including the notorious Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, were killed by U.S. forces in tandem with the Iraqi government. That collaboration formed the next link in the chain that led to al-Baghdadi's death. This story is one of professional cooperation, shared goals, and keeping everyone on the same page. By doctrine and training, U.S. Special Operations Forces work jointly with others, from the CIA to the Iraqi military and intelligence, and the Syrian Kurds, who dispatched agents along the routes al-Baghdadi was thought to use, tracing him to a compound near the Turkish border. The Kurds had a man on the inside. Their general Mazlum Abdi told reporters afterward. Abdi said, a member of al-Baghdadi's security detail smuggled out soiled underwear and even a blood sample for DNA testing that confirmed the ISIS leader's presence. The agent also described the layout of the compound in detail, including a tunnel. Parenthetically, the reward for information leading the U.S. to al-Baghdadi was $25 million. Planning began for a capture-or-kill operation carried out by the Army's elite Delta Force and Ranger Regiment troops. The mission was named in part for Kayla Mueller, the U.S. aid worker kidnapped by ISIS in 2013 and raped by al-Baghdadi. On October 26th, the operation went off without incident. Commandos flying from Iraq in 8 CH-47 Chinooks and other helicopters, breaching a high wall surrounding the compound, and pursuing al-Baghdadi into the tunnel, a dead end where he detonated a suicide vest, killing the two children he had taken with him. President Donald Trump watched the video feeds in the White House Situation Room. We move on to include more material from this particular issue. There are more details about that al-Baghdadi story. We're still in the brief, and this section is the news. And in the margin of this page is a sidebar feature, News Ticker. Three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Boeing CEO testifies on, quote, mistakes, unquote. Dennis Muilenburg, CEO of Boeing, testified before Congress on October 29th, his first such appearance since two Boeing 737 MAX aircraft crashed and killed 346 people. He acknowledged that flight control software was involved in the accidents and said the company, quote, made mistakes, unquote. Central item, 39 found dead in UK truck. On October 23rd, the bodies of 8 women and 31 men were found in a refrigerated truck in Essex, east of London. UK police have not named the victims, but initially believed they were Chinese nationals who had been smuggled into the country. The driver was charged on October 26th with manslaughter and conspiracy to traffic people. Bottom item, VA fails to establish accountability. The Department of Veterans Affairs Office of Accountability and Whistleblower Protection is actually endangering whistleblowers, an Inspector General's report found on October 24th. Established in 2017 under the Trump administration, the office was meant to improve accountability in a department previously beset by scandal. On the facing page, the subsection is Business, where the headline is, A Beta Test for Big Tech's Clout by Alana Samuels. Name a policy supported by a Democratic presidential candidate this year, and odds are good it's been passed into law in Seattle. The Emerald City has approved a $15 minimum wage, parenthetically, which Elizabeth Warren calls for, unveiled a domestic workers' bill of rights, parenthetically, like the one Kamala Harris wants, and voted to tax the rich, parenthetically, a Bernie Sanders-backed plan, though that's tied up in court. But Seattle's business leaders are pushing back, pouring hundreds of thousands of dollars into an upcoming election in an effort to unseat the city's progressive leadership in favor of contenders who, while still Democrats, take more moderate positions on fiscal issues. Quote, there's a basic feeling that the city council isn't doing a good job, and we don't want them to take actions that are going to hurt the one thing that is going well in our town, the economy, unquote, says Heather Redman, a venture capitalist and the chair of the Washington Technology Industry Association, whose membership includes Amazon and Microsoft. With an unprecedented 7 of 9 city council seats up for grabs on November 5th, the election offers local business leaders a rare opportunity to hit Seattle's political reset button. Quote, the Chamber of Commerce sees this election as a way to take control of the council, unquote, says Knut Berger, a columnist for Seattle Magazine. The outcome is likely to resonate nationally as cities across the country get caught up in the struggle between progressive politicians and corporate interests. Seattle's left-leaning council members, like Teresa Mosqueda, say their policies have helped, not hurt, the city's economy. The Seattle metro area has a 3.6% unemployment rate, compared with the state average of 4.6%. And taxable retail sales in Seattle have grown 42% since 2014, according to state data. Last year, Forbes named Seattle the best place in the country for business and careers. Tech companies in particular have boomed. Quote, I think part of what has made this economy so good is the fact that we've invested in workers, unquote, says Mosqueda. The tech sector disagrees. Amazon has given around $1.5 million to a political action committee, parenthetically PAC, sponsored by Seattle's Chamber of Commerce, that has endorsed non-incumbents for all but one seat. Amazon executives have given the maximum $500 to many of the candidates running against incumbents, and the maximum $5,000 to a PAC that says it wants a, quote, pragmatic, unquote, council. Amazon donated to the chamber's PAC, quote, because we care about the economic health of Seattle and the region, unquote, a spokesperson says. Other companies that donated to the PAC this year include Expedia, $50,000, and Boeing, $30,000. How might tech's big money affect the upcoming election? Last year, amid a mounting homelessness crisis, Seattle passed a $275 per employee tax on big businesses to pay for housing and related programs. After the vote, businesses spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to send the tax to a ballot referendum. In the face of intense corporate pressure, many of the council members who voted in favor of the tax went back and voted to repeal it. The embarrassing do-over was a big win for Seattle's business community at the cost of a major progressive achievement. As cities become more liberal nationwide, tensions between business leaders and elected officials are likely only to rise. Around 62% of registered voters in urban counties identified as Democrats in 2017, according to Pew, up from 55% in 1998. Seattle's election may be a test of whether businesses' significant money will be able to sway these increasingly liberal urbanites, either now or in the future. Quote, if they do this here, unquote, says Heather Weiner, a Seattle political consultant, quote, they'll be doing it around the country, unquote. And that was the entire article by Alana Samuels. That brings us to the milestones page. Lead item under died, John Conyers, long-serving legislator. Observance by Elena Abramson. When John Conyers, Jr. arrived on Capitol Hill in 1965, there were just five other African-Americans serving in the U.S. Congress. As the size of that group expanded, parenthetically, to 56 today, so did its influence, in no small part because of legislators like Conyers. The former Michigan congressman who died on October 27th at 90 was the longest-serving African-American lawmaker in history. a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus. Conyers used his seniority to carry forward the values of the civil rights movement. He battled to make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a national holiday and regularly introduced reparations bills. Quote, "The fights John Conyers fought will be remembered for generations," unquote, said fellow Michigan Representative Debbie Dingell. But in 2017, he was mired in controversy over sexual harassment allegations. Although he denied the claims, he resigned, and amid pressure from colleagues. Quote, "I hope," unquote, he said in a statement when he stepped down, quote, "that my retirement will be viewed in the larger perspective of my record," unquote. History will determine whether his wish comes true. Entire observance by Elena Abramson, John Conyers. Underclosed, Uluru, Australia's sacred summit. Uluru is spelled U-L-U-R-U. Observance by Belinda Luscombe, who writes, when asked why he was climbing Mount Everest, George Mallory famously answered, quote, "because it's there," unquote. Australians, when asked why they don't climb their land's most notable natural feature, might answer, quote, "because it's theirs," unquote. On October 26th, Uluru, the brutal red Inselberg almost smack bang in the center of the continent, was officially closed to climbers, marking the end of a long campaign to honor the wishes of its original custodians. One of Australia's most iconic tourist spots, and the only reason anyone would linger in the Great Sandy Desert, Uluru, known for decades as Ayers Rock, has been withdrawn from public consumption slowly. In 1985, Uluru, Kata Tujuta National Park, was returned to the Anangu people, who leased it to the park's department. Signs and brochures began to ask visitors not to climb, and the proportion who defied that request has been below 20% for nearly a decade. So many former visitors returned pieces of Uluru they'd taken, a sort of repatriation by mail, that the fragments became known as, quote, "sorry rocks," unquote. Australia is a firmly secular nation, but the sacredness of Uluru has been hard to miss. The novelist Thomas Keneally described it as a continental belly button where, quote, "the ancestor heroes cut the umbilical cord that connected earth to heaven," unquote. An Anangu elder wrote that if photo-taking tourists could shoot an image of the being inside the rock, they'd throw away their cameras. What visitors usually capture instead is the almost mystical transition from pink to fiery red as the rock mirrors the passing day. For Uluru and its people, it's dawn again. This item is accompanied by a full-color photograph. The caption says, "Visitors on Uluru on October 10th. Attendance soared at Uhuru Kathia Juta National Park in the months before the climbing ban took effect." And going up the mountain, which is barren, is a long line of climbers and tourists. We go now to another item under milestones. Died Kay Hagan, who served one term as senator from North Carolina. Kay Hagan died on October 28th at 66. Under died Robert Evans, producer of Chinatown and The Godfather, died on October 26th at 89. Under agreed, UK lawmakers to allow a general election on December 12th after the EU granted Boris Johnson's request to delay Brexit until January. Under changed, the name of the Vatican Secret Archive to the less mysterious-sounding Vatican Apostolic Archive, changed by Pope Francis on October 28th. He said the former name had negative connotations. Under blocked, North Carolina, from using congressional districts that showed, quote, extreme partisan gerrymandering, unquote, to favor Republicans in the 2020 election, blocked by a panel of state judges on October 28th. Under attacked, more than 2,000 websites in the country of Georgia on October 28th. Affected sites showed a photo of former president Mikhail Saakashvili and the phrase, quote, I'll be back, unquote. Under appointed, Sophie Wilmès to be the first female prime minister of Belgium, appointed by King Philippe on October 27th. Under pleaded, guilty by Jared Ramos on October 28th to the June 2018 Capitol Gazette shooting in Annapolis, Maryland, which killed 5 people. The entire contents of the milestones page. On the facing page is another version of the sidebar feature news ticker. Once again, 3 news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, new TB vaccine could save millions. An experimental vaccine against tuberculosis, the world's deadliest infectious disease, could save millions of lives, according to a study published October 29th. The vaccine has about a 50% success rate, which bodes well for at least some of the 1.6 million people who die of TB every year. Middle item, Davos fined for contempt of court. A federal judge fined Education Secretary Betsy DeVos $100,000 for contempt of court on October 24th, saying her department violated an order to halt debt collection from victims defrauded by since-shuttered Corinthian colleges. The for-profit chain was found to have misled recruits and lied about graduate employment. Corinthian colleges. Bottom item, China imposes new morality rules. The Chinese Communist Party unveiled a sweeping list of new morality guidelines on October 27th, instructing citizens in, quote, national etiquette, unquote, to, quote, defend China's honor, unquote, abroad. The diktat comes as China faces months of protests in Hong Kong against its authoritarian rule. Moving ahead, and still in the brief, we are now in the major subsection called Health, where the headline is, how a discontinued Alzheimer's drug study got a second life. Article by Alice Park. Quote, my first reaction was to be angry, unquote, says Joanne Wooding. Quote, I've gotten over that, and frustration is more the word right now, unquote. Wooding's husband, Peter, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2016, was among the more than 3,200 people with the disease who volunteered to test a promising drug called aducanumab, and I will spell that, A-D-U-C-A-N-U-M-A-B, aducanumab. In earlier study results released the same year, the drug developed by Biogen, a U.S. biotech company, and Eisai, a Japanese pharmaceutical manufacturer, Eisai spelled E-I-S-A-I, seemed to accomplish a number of firsts for people with Alzheimer's. Without the names of the two firms, I will repeat the gist of that last sentence fragment. The drug seemed to accomplish a number of firsts for people with Alzheimer's. It appeared to shrink deposits of the protein amyloid accumulating in the brains of patients, and, perhaps more important, also slow the cognitive decline resulting from their buildup. No drug for the disease had shown such dramatic effects before. The study in which Peter was participating was one of two follow-up trials designed to confirm that early promise and patients and doctors hoped lead to the first approved treatment that could actually slow the progression of the neurodegenerative disease. But last March, Biogen, after an early review of its data involving half the patients, decided the results were not promising enough to continue exposing patients to possible side effects and terminated the trial. Peter and the other volunteers stopped receiving infusions, and the company began a more in-depth analysis. The resulting full report, which included all 3,285 patients, revealed a rosier picture. After 18 months of taking aducanumab, people in one of the studies showed anywhere from 15% to 27% less cognitive decline, as measured by standard tests of memory and cognitive ability, compared with those receiving a placebo. The cognitive protection was most pronounced in those getting the highest dose of the drug. On the basis of these results, the company plans to ask the Food and Drug Administration to approve aducanumab for the treatment of early Alzheimer's disease. Quote, in retrospect, the analysis last spring was incorrect, says, unquote, says Dr. Alfred Sandrock, chief medical officer at Biogen. Quote, but based on the data we had at the time, we followed the science and made the decision to terminate the studies. With the additional data and the additional analysis, we now know the drug has efficacy, unquote. The news is bittersweet for the Woodings, who feel they have lost precious time in holding off the disease ravaging Peter's brain. After being randomly assigned to receive either aducanumab or a placebo once a month for 18 months, all the volunteers were then given the opportunity to receive the drug for at least 2 years. Peter had completed his 18-month test period and had received his fifth infusion of the active drug when Biogen pulled the plug. Quote, when he was off the drug, there were some changes, with his short-term memory being the most affected, unquote, says Joanne. Quote, over time, I could see a difference without the drug, unquote. How could two different reviews of the data lead to such startlingly different conclusions? Quote, as a scientist, I was completely confused, unquote, says Samantha Budd Haberlein, head of Biogen's late-stage clinical development for Alzheimer's. Quote, how could it be, when we had such clear data from the early clinical trial, such compelling data? The scientist in me was really irritated. What the hell happened? Unquote. When she and a team of statisticians and programmers looked at the entirety of the data, one of the studies showed a clearly positive trend in reducing cognitive decline, while the other did not show much change in cognitive functions at all. The two studies were identical in terms of the types of patients enrolled and how they were randomly assigned to receive aducanumab or the placebo. The only distinction was that one study began earlier than the other. That made a difference, Haberlein believes, since Biogen changed protocols of the study after patients began enrolling. Importantly, the very first people to volunteer were given much lower doses of the drug if they had a mutation of the ApoE gene that raises a person's risk for Alzheimer's, and also seemed to raise the risk of experiencing brain inflammation as a side effect of aducanumab. About two-thirds of the people who participated in the studies carried this high-risk gene. New data that became available after these patients began receiving their infusions, however, revealed that slightly higher doses did not actually result in a marked increase in side effects. So, these patients were then given higher doses. But many had either not yet or just begun their new doses when the company analyzed its data on the first half of patients last spring and decided to end the study. Over the summer, after seeing the positive results from all the participants, Haberlein grew skeptical. She dug deeper, breaking out how the patients receiving the lower doses fared on their cognitive tests. Those people showed some improvements, more than the placebo group, but not as great as those at the higher doses. Quote, "That was when we as a team said, 'Holy cow,'" unquote. She walked across the Biogen campus, quote, "on wobbly knees," unquote, and pulled Sandrock out of a meeting, saying, quote, "We've got to talk," unquote. Other data supported the positive effect of aducanumab. For example, brain scans measuring changes in the amount of amyloid buildup showed declines in the plaques among people getting the highest doses of the drug. Quote, "Patients can't influence the proteins in their brain," unquote, says Haberlein. Quote, "These wonderful readouts gave us further confidence that what we were looking at was very strong," unquote. Biogen is now working with its study sites and the FDA to launch a new trial in which the original study participants would be invited back to receive aducanumab, parenthetically, with no placebo group. The news is providing much-needed hope for the Alzheimer's field, which has been battered by a series of failed drug trials over the past decade. Quote, "These are lots of..." I'll repeat that for clarity, with apologies. Quote, "There are lots of implications for these results," unquote, says Maria Carrillo, chief science officer of the Alzheimer's Association. Quote, "This is the very first time in the field that we have had the type of positive news that could be transformational," unquote. After his study was stopped in the spring, Peter joined another trial testing a different type of experimental treatment. To join Biogen's new study, He will have to wait for it to be launched and then for the drug he is currently testing to wash out of his system, which could take months. Even with those hurdles, would he start taking aducanumab again? Quote, I would, unquote, he says. Quote, hopefully we can make a difference with this disease. We have to stick with it and make a touchdown. Unquote. Entire article by Alice Park, which does feature a quotation pulled out of the article in red, quotation from Maria Carrillo, Chief Science Officer, Alzheimer's Association. And the quotation is, quote, this is the very first time in the field that we have had the type of positive news that could be transformational, unquote, in red. Moving ahead, this section is called Nation. The headline is Rudy Cashes In by Vera Bergengruen and Brian Bennett. In the storied career of America's most famous mayor, the last 5 weeks have been quite a chapter. During a shouting match on CNN on September 19th, Rudy Giuliani denied and then, 30 seconds later, admitted to playing a central role in President Donald Trump's efforts to get a foreign country to investigate his top 2020 rival, Joe Biden. 5 days later, Giuliani went nuclear on a radio host during a joint TV appearance, shouting, quote, shut up, moron, shut up, unquote, as he tried to drown out accusations that he was making things up. Trump's personal lawyer capped it off on October 16th by pocket-dialing a reporter for NBC News and inadvertently leaving a lengthy message as he talked to an unidentified partner about potentially lucrative business in Turkey and Bahrain. Some people were worried. Giuliani's longtime associates, Bernard Carrick, says he keeps getting asked, quote, is he okay, unquote. Walter Mack, who ran an organized crime unit for Giuliani back when they were prosecutors in Manhattan in the 1980s, says he wonders the same. Mack says if you saw him now, quote, I would talk to him as a friend and a fellow prosecutor and just be certain he was getting good advice and that he was not losing sight of his own standards and morals, unquote. Carrick, who was Giuliani's top cop in New York and later served 3 years in federal prison for tax fraud and other crimes, talks regularly with his old friend. And we have run out of time for this edition of Time Magazine. We certainly appreciate you being with us, and we certainly appreciate your patience with your reader, which is me, Randall Rickman. You've been listening to North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The content of this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. And I see now that we have actually been able to add time to our broadcast, and I am now going to add, and we can pick up where we left off. So we get bonus time here. We're listening to quotations from Bernard Carrick. Carrick, who was Giuliani's top cop in New York and later served 3 years in federal prison for tax fraud and other crimes, talks regularly with his old friend. Giuliani, he says, is just, quote, vocal now, quote, unquote, now that he doesn't have to worry about, quote, running for office, unquote. But it's a bewildering turn of events for a person who, at one point in his career, had been among the most admired public figures in the country. Giuliani was always colorful. As mayor, he was a New York archetype come to life. the fast-talking, bronze-accented Wheeler dealer, complete with mistresses, sharp suits, and primo seats at Yankee Stadium. And many loved him for being an iconoclast. He was the law-and-order mayor who cleaned up Times Square, a Republican who believed in gun control and gay rights, a self-described pro-choice Republican, as at home at the city's glimmering galas as at the televised perp walk of a criminal. With exuberant FU energy, that is a direct quote from Time, he seemed to embody the city itself. And for the brief post 9/11 moment when Americans were all New Yorkers, the whole country became Giuliani's constituents, too. His latest brush with history is revealing a darker side, something that suggests not just Giuliani unbound, but untethered from the values he once espoused. And as the House impeachment inquiry accelerates, and witness after witness describes Giuliani as the prime enabler behind what Democrats say are impeachable offenses committed by Trump, Giuliani's behavior may end up having historic consequences. So what is going on with him? Interviews with those close to the former mayor and those who have crossed paths with him in his work for Trump say Giuliani's transformation has a simple source. Over the past 18 months, he has violated that unwritten rule of American public life that you can pursue money or political power, but not both at once. There's nothing particularly exceptional about riding the revolving door from having power to making money and back again. And for years, Giuliani has pursued both with relish. After leaving the mayoralty, Giuliani cashed in with book deals, high-priced speaking engagements, and a lucrative, if murky, consulting business that counted Carter, Purdue Pharma, and a range of controversial foreign personalities as top clients. After a brief and failed attempt to get back into power as a candidate for president in 2008, he returned to the money game. By 2018, he was making between $5 million and $10 million a year. What's different now is that Giuliani is doing both at the same time. In the 18 months since Trump hired him as his personal lawyer in April 2018, Giuliani has become a kind of shadow Secretary of State, even as he has maintained his foreign consulting business. He has been often treated as a de facto envoy of the U.S. government while abroad, at the same time receiving lucrative consulting and speaking fees from foreign officials and businessmen. His quest has been enabled by Trump, who entrusted Giuliani with cabinet-level influence. When Energy Secretary Rick Perry pushed Trump in May to meet with Ukraine's new president, for example, Trump told him to, quote, visit with Rudy, unquote, according to an interview Perry gave the Wall Street Journal. And an aide to former National Security Advisor John Bolton told congressional impeachment investigators that Giuliani was running a parallel foreign policy outside the normal channels of U.S. diplomacy. Meanwhile, as Trump's cable news defender and then his personal lawyer, Giuliani remained technically a private citizen, unencumbered by long-standing ethics rules designed to prevent officials from using public service for personal gain. And gain he did, where the salary of the actual Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was $210,700 last year. Until the past few years, Giuliani seemed to enjoy a lavish, approximately $230,000 a month lifestyle that includes six homes, access to private jets, and 11 country club memberships, according to his recent divorce court filings published by the New York Times. Giuliani says there's nothing wrong with continuing his consulting for foreign clients while at the same time representing the president. Quote, of course I don't mix the two things, unquote, he told Time in a phone interview He said people pay him as a lawyer and security expert, and because he has, quote, done some remarkable things that nobody else has ever done, unquote. Quote, everything I'm doing now is similar to what I did in the past, unquote, Giuliani says. His critics say that is exactly the problem. As he jetted around, mixing his access to Trump with his personal business, they began asking whose interests was he serving? America's? Trump's? His own? Much of the work that Giuliani has done remains undisclosed. Few know which foreign interests are paying him, how much they're paying, or what exactly they're getting in return. But amid the many self-dealing scandals besetting the Trump administration, Giuliani's adventures went largely ignored at first, and he might have happily continued his money power play, but for one thing, Ukraine. Things began going wrong around April, when Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe was drawing to a close. Fighting Mueller had been job one for Giuliani, and it brought him closer than ever to the president. And now we have indeed run out of time for this edition of Time Magazine. Once again, let me thank you for your patience with your reader on this edition. And if you do have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. I'm Randall Rickman, and you've been listening to North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Please join us again for the next edition of Time.